They just make power unpredictable. It's a tactic historically favored by Storm Scourge riders. He and Eater ride their emotions like a roller coaster, whose direction only they can predict, and power gives him rein to fire at will. But Ayla and I can dodge almost anything. So as the match starts, I let power take the offensive, Ayla and I playing hopscotch between Eater's jets of ash, staying close, keeping him firing, keeping him busy. The minutes tick past, and Ayla and I dodge, weave, and dodge again. But even if you're flying at your best, you can't help tiring eventually, and mistakes happen. After about 10 minutes, we turn just a little too shallowly, and I feel a blistering heat across my left calf. I can't contain a hiss of pain. It's a full heat burn, the kind we aren't even allowed to dole out in training. The shining armor blackens, reacting to the heat, and a bell for the first penalty rings out across the stands. Ayla senses my pain, even if she's impervious to the heat. She pulls out of range and waits as I unplug the coolant shaft set in the calf of my flame suit. Cool liquid pours down my leg, soothing the burn, though it's severe enough that the pain doesn't fade entirely. But the coolant will hold off the worst of it for another half hour, which is all I need. Every second I spend out of range is one gained by Eater, and I need to keep him firing if I want to deplete him, so I bring Ayla round without further pause. We begin a second round. Minutes blur together into dodging and gambling and shots fired to my left and right and back as I focus only on reaction and response. Until the second penalty hits. I fail to dodge Power's jackknife turn, and Eater's ash, full heat, sears my arms. In the timeout before reset, I fumble to open the coolant shafts at my elbows, with fingers stiff in their gloves, then twist the reins around my wrists, relieving my fingers of the need to clench. Even as I struggle to master the reins, I feel the adrenaline and pain loosening me, pushing me closer to Ayla. The heightened connection fills me with a different kind of calm. Ayla and I are on our last chance. 3 penalties counts as a kill shot. We reset for a third round.
"It's over, Annie," Power calls.
He's grinning as he replaces his helmet. The emotions he's freely spilling over are clearly verging on euphoria. I re-enter his range. He resumes firing. As Ayla and I begin once more to swerve and dodge, I note what Power in his transported state has not. Eater's ash has begun every few meters to sputter. I turn Ayla and pull her to a halt. Power and I are facing each other. I'm exposed within Power's range. I can make out his glittering triumphant eyes through the visor of his helmet. The arena is spread below us, and the clouds obscuring the top of Pytho's keep hang low and close. Eater opens his mouth for a kill shot. And nothing comes out. Power's eyes widen. In the split second that it takes me to surge forward and fire, he launches upward. My shot misses everything but Eater's trailing tail. And then Power and Eater disappear into the cloud cover. For a moment, Ayla and I are stalled, looking up into the clouds where Power has vanished. Power's intention is as clear as if he'd announced it. 2 rules of tournament sparring that both of us know. First, that contact charges are off limits between dragons of different breeds during sporting events. Second, that whatever happens out of sight of the referee is considered fair game. If I go into those clouds, Eater will tackle Ayla. He's more than half her size. But if I wait, his lungs will recover, and every moment that I wait, the coolant wears off a bit more, and the pain becomes just a little more consuming. "Are we doing this?" I say to Ayla. But Ayla is already rising,
and I don't have to urge her with anything more than a shared determination. The passage up through the stratus cloud is quiet, disorienting in its seamless uniformity of grey. I can feel Ayla's heart pounding in time with my own. When we break through, I have a split second to realize that there's an altostratus layer of clouds blanketing the sky still higher, and that we're between layers, lost in a strange grey-white light. The only remaining sign of land is the top of Pytho's keep, a few hundred meters away, rising out of the stratus like a floating fortress. I see all of this in the half instant before Eta slams into us from behind. Ayla shrieks and twists while Eta's talons sink into the pauldron protecting my shoulder, puncturing the armor and flame suit, sinking into my skin. The talons of his other forearm are sinking into Ayla's back. She screams, and I feel it, her pain bursting in a haze through my own. And then I feel her fury. Fine. You want to play dirty? We'll play dirty. I reach with burn clumsy fingers for my boot knife and slash over and over against the inside of Eater's forearms, and he shrieks and pulls his talons out of us. Ayla twists us round, and then, though she's gained the leverage to break free of Eater, she doesn't. She claws her way up his torso, scrabbling with him arm and leg. Both dragons' wings are beating madly, keeping us aloft and stalling, blocking each rider's sight of the other as they lock in their embrace. Then Ayla sinks her talons into the membrane of Eater's inner wing. He shrieks. Power cries out, and Eater curls the wing into his side. And then, finally, as we begin to freefall with only three wings holding two dragons aloft, Eater's folded wing gives us an opening straight onto Power's crouched form. Ayla fires, full heat. Power disappears in the smoke. Then she kicks off from Eater and Power with a shriek of disgust. The smoke clears. Power's armor is blackened. He sits dazed, lost in the shock of a full heat blast. Numbly, automatically, he begins to open his torso coolant shafts. Do you yield? We're poised at firing distance to hit him again, and Eater's still empty. Power's voice comes out in a low gasp. Yeah. Helmet, I demand. Proof and guarantee of a match won in the absence of a referee. Power lets out a hoarse laugh, but doesn't question my precaution. With shaking hands, he lifts his helmet from his head. His hair is glistening with sweat, his face scudded with tracks of ash. For one inscrutable moment, he stares at me, eyes so dilated from spillover that they look black. Then he tosses his soot-covered helmet through the open air. I catch it. We descend together through the stratus. When we burst back into sight of the arena, there's an explosion of noise. It takes me a moment to realize it is cheering, and it's for me. Like someone else has possessed my body, I lift Power's helmet above my head and shake it for the world to see. There's a confusion of shouting once we land on the Eyrie. Duck is jumping up and down, Krissa is screaming in delight, and Lee is there, helping me cut my boots free of their straps, guiding me off the saddle, and taking stock of my injuries with careful fingers. I can no longer move my fingers or my left leg, and my shoulder, which is dripping blood, is stiff with pain. I can still feel Ayla's pulsing heartbeat and searing wound like my own. Lee's arm grips me below the shoulder, steadying me.
Annie, are you all right?
Gorin's voice seems to come from a great distance. He sounds concerned. It's so surprising that I laugh out loud. Power is nowhere to be seen, so it's into Gorin's hands that I push Power's helmet. I'm great. Lee's grip on my arm tightens as he turns me toward him.
Annie, we've got to do the concluding ceremony. Can you make it through?
The concluding ceremony. For the finalists. You and me, I realize. Lee is holding me upright, one arm around me, the other steadying me, his face just inches from mine. His gray eyes are piercing and proud and just a little pained. The sweat and ash have dried in tracks down his face. You and me, he repeats quietly. All of a sudden, I feel like crying. I waver again. The coolant is definitely wearing off, as is the adrenaline. The eerie is starting to fade in and out.
Can she fly up? Goran asks.
Not with Ayla being tended. I'll walk her. That'll be easier. Lee's arm against my back, firm and purposeful. Down to the arena stands, then up the stairs to the palace box. People are cheering, screaming when they see us, but the sound feels muffled. I could have killed you when you went into the Stratus after him, Lee says, as we mount the stairs, admiration battling with exasperation in his voice. That sneak, pulling a contact charge. When we reach the palace box, he releases my side so none of the waiting ministers can see that he'd been supporting me. The last time I stood in this place, I was numb with terror. Today, I have no thoughts for that. Let the ministry think what it thinks. Let propaganda write me another memo. I've done it. I've beaten power. For the moment, I have to focus all my attention on walking. One step after another, with Lee beside me, down the aisle to where the first protector stands, smiling.
My two finalists, he says with warmth in his voice.
It does not seem to be a scripted line. There are more ceremonial words, then the weight of the laurel placed over my head, and then Ayla's presence, close, as I slip a laurel down her long neck and she rumbles with pride.
A week before Palace Day, we will gather for our last and most important tournament,
Atreus tells the audience.
One of these finalists will become Alternus, Lieutenant and Defender of the People, and one will become First Rider, their champion. Lee and Antigone, we wish you luck in your final months of training.
Later that evening, I lie half awake in the darkened palace infirmary. Master Wellesley has already headed home for the night. The infirmary is deserted when the door to my ward creaks open. Hushed voices, giggling, a few silhouetted heads peering in. Chris's voice comes out low and playful. Annie! I sit up from my pillows, my burns twinging.
What are you doing?
Chrissa flings open the door, and light from the corridor spills in. Behind her stand the other girls, Deirdre and Alexa. Inseparable for as long as we've been in the program, and also Orla, who usually avoids group activities in favor of her books. Her presence particularly signifies that something unusual is afoot.
We're here to take you to your party, Chrissa announces.
I'm so startled that my first thought is why she isn't at Lee's party. She is, after all, his friend.
What about Lee?
The Aurelian Squadron's taking care of him. We're taking care of you.
We, the female guardians. A few of the boys, too, behind them, though I can't make out their faces. My heart constricts, touched and surprised that they're here at all. I hadn't thought of celebrations, and if I had, I'd have assumed they'd be for Lee. But then I remember my burns. I can't really walk for a day at least. Physician's orders.
Not a problem, Chrissa says, unperturbed. And then with the air of summoning a dragon, she bellows, Richard!
A tall, sturdy figure makes his way through the girls and crouches by my bed. Rock. And then he deploys the brogue he usually pretends not to have. The brogue of home.
Up you get, finalist.
I burst out laughing. You can't be serious. But they are serious indeed. Deirdre and Alexa hoist me onto Rock's shoulders, and Krissa hurls what looks like a blanket over my back, but it turns out to be a Kallipolan flag, its wing-spread dragon breathing four circlets of fire against red. Orla seizes the laurel lying on the bedside table and reaches up on tiptoe to mash it on my head. Duck, standing in the doorway, holds one of Gorin's training horns to his lips and blows. The silence of the infirmary breaks like an explosion.
To the pickled boar!
The Pickled Boar is a tavern on the other side of the river in Highmarket, popular among the lowborn guardians. I've never been before. Duck's shout is taken up by the other girls, and I marched out of the infirmary. The passage through the palace gardens, across the river, and into Highmarket passes in a blur. The moonlit gardens crossed with loping speed that I mark from Rock's great height as I cling to the Kallipan flag around my shoulders. The silhouettes of Deirdre and Alexa and Orla streaking around us, shrieking and screaming and giggling in the darkness as Krissa cries, "Onward!" like she's leading a charge. And Duck blowing the horn like he's determined to destroy the palace's usual peaceful silence. Highmarket is awash with noise. We're not the only ones who took the tournament as an excuse to celebrate, and it seems that in the wake of the threat from new pythos, it has a lot of steam to blow off. Kallipolan flags everywhere. Horns everywhere, being sold by enterprising street merchants and blown from the streets and the balconies, amid a cacophony of shrieking and choruses of drunken singing, and even the occasional low throb of a street drum. Ale sloshes and toasts and forms sticky puddles on the cobblestones. Sheets have been painted with messages and hung from second-story windows. Lowborn takes the laurel. Long live the revolution, down with new pythos. At the door of the Pickled Boar, when Krissa helps me to the ground, I protest the flaw I've just realized in her plan. Krissa, we've all sworn vows of poverty. How are we supposed to buy ourselves drinks? Krissa and Rock let out thunderous laughs. Trust me, Krissa says, throwing her arm around my flag-draped shoulders and not noticing as I wince. You're not going to have to buy yourself a drink tonight. And then she ushers me into the tavern. Candles and sconces light a room full of laughter, faces painted with the Kallipolan colours, a group of musicians in the corner hammering on drums and plucking at fiddles that send not so much music as rhythm into my blood. As soon as we're inside, Krissa leaps onto the closest empty chair and summons up the voice she usually reserves for commanding her squadron from Dragonback, spreading an arm wide in my direction.
Ladies and gentlemen of Kallipolis, I give you your Highland finalist!
Amid roars of applause that deafen, Rock seizes my fist and thrusts it into the air. And then I am surrounded, my shoulders, still tender with burns and a talon's piercing, thumped by complete strangers. It hurts, but even so, I'm beaming.
Whiskey for the Highlander!
I'm passed a drink whose fumes alone makes my eyes water, and as I set my lips to it, I begin to splutter. But the bristle-bearded man who's handed it to me only cheers the more, those around us laughing with delight as they applaud.
Antigone Sir Ayla's first whiskey! Drink up, lassie! Drink to the revolution! Another!
And then the musicians begin playing the anthem of the revolution.
and it's hard to say whether the strength of the whiskey or the shivers of the melody down my spine makes my eyes fill. And I raise my glass and sing with the rest the song of my country. We rise. We rise for the glory of Kallipolis.
Chapter 7. Morale Visits. Lee.
The first class with Tyndale after the tournament, I find a note tucked into the homework he returns to me. Cousin, I gave him two letters. This is the one for if you made it. Do you remember how the dreams of glory sang in our blood as we were children when we pretended to wage war? They were the dreams that I remembered when I made first rider of New Pythos. We have so many things to discuss, you and I. But before we do, I want you to know this, that I, your cousin, your blood, hope you make first rider as much as I hoped I would myself. Perhaps it's madness to wish such a thing with the future looming over us as it does. But the truth is that however it ends, I want you to taste it. My kin, my first friend. I want you to know what it's like to feel the might of the world at your feet. Not in pretend, in earnest. And then I hope you let yourself imagine how it could go from there. You and I, retaking what's ours. Making those bastards pay for what they've done. Setting things right. Our fathers may be dead, but their blood runs in our veins. We were born to this. Give me the time and place for our next meeting. The day I receive Julia's letter, the first rider tournament is a month away, set for a week before the Palace Day anniversary and 2 weeks after the Lycian Ball. I reread it, even as I appreciate it for what it is, a temptation. Julia's words awaken the old hunger and trace it to its starting point, to wanting first rider for as long as I can remember, as any Dragonlord's son would, as my birthright. It's easy to slip into such thinking. It's easy to yearn after thoughts of revenge. We were born to this. I can't think of any answer that wouldn't be a lie in its denial, so I don't acknowledge the temptation at all. I propose a meeting at Wayfarer's Arch, a dragon perch built on an island arch that's midway between the cast pillars of New Pythos and the Kallipolan northern shore. Midnight on the next full moon, a week before the Lycian Ball. I tell myself that I do it in Kallipolis's name, even if it's without Kallipolis's knowledge. I tell myself that the more information I can gather about the Pythian fleet, the better. And I tell myself that I will make first rider with a different set of principles.
Annie.
The burns from the semi-final tournament have begun to itch, and the dressings still require changing and ointment several times a day. On the first patrol I run with Power after the tournament, I expect him to be taciturn, and possibly even in the mood for retribution. I have my pike, sharpened for real combat rather than the blunt kind we train with, gripped loose and ready under my arm. Power Sir Eater on the outside of it. But as we leave the city behind and steer the dragons toward the northern coast, Power reins Eater to chatting distance and pulls his helmet off his head.
So, what's your plan? He calls.
I raise my visor too.
What?
The fields of the lowland plains roll out below us, emerald green from summer crops freshly burst from the earth. Here and there, the spires of dragon perches, mounted with bells and unlit beacons, tower over toy-sized villages.
For beating Lee. In the final tournament. I could be your training partner.
I laugh aloud. The last time we were in the air together, Eater's talons pierced my shoulder and Ayla's side in an illegal charge that we're still recovering from. The burns that they gave me itch badly enough that sitting still, in class, in the saddle, takes concentration. You think I'd train with you? Power slings his reins into one hand, twists a shoulder back to face me and cocks an eyebrow.
I think you'd better, if you want to beat him. I could teach you spillovers, you'd be suited to them. We can start after the Lycian ball. Our schedules will be clearer then.
For graduating Gold students, the Lycian ball marks their transition to contributing members of the elite. For the Guardians this year, it will serve as our debut to Gold society. Between now and then, many professors have been setting end-of-year assignments and final exams that the Guardians, expanded military and public obligations notwithstanding, are still expected to complete.
You're going to have to train for this tournament. He's pretty good,
Power adds. An understatement, but the closest thing to a compliment he's ever said about Lee.
You should have some sort of plan.
Some sort of plan. The problem is, I don't. Making finalist and finding myself opposite Lee was like breaking the grey-white nothingness of stratus clouds and bursting into the sunlight above them. Blinding. And I'm still dazed by it. It's strange how you can fight your way to a door, even through it, without thinking about what lies on the other side. Fourth Order finalists, titles I've clawed my way into and have found, upon seizing them, that I like how they settle. But First Rider? Commander of the Kallipolin Aerial Fleet? First Rider and Fleet Commander instead of Lee? You must really want Lee to lose, I observe. The North Sea approaches, a grey swath on the horizon, punctuated by cliffs. But Power is watching me, not the ground below, and flashes a sudden grin.
Maybe I want you to win, because I think you'd do a better job than that self-satisfied ass. Because I think you've got the head and the guts for it, and that you do a good job, period. That too hard to imagine, Annie? That somebody wants you to win?
Even though he seems to intend it as a compliment, in tone it feels more like an insult. When he realizes I'm not going to answer, he keeps going. The disgust in his voice is apparent, even when he's lifting it over the wind.
You probably don't even want you to win. You'd rather be his alterna than go for commandership. You don't know anything about me, Power.
Yeah? I know what they say about you.
About me?
They say serfs are always happiest when they have a lord.
I haul Ayla to a halt, mid-air so hard that I rock forward in the saddle and she hawks against the bit. Power has to circle round to face us. The northern coastline, Fort Aron and its harbour stretch below, and the rising cliffs of the highlands spread west, green grass and violet heather both bleached silver under the cumulus-laden sky.
I take it back, Power says easily, spreading his hands in surrender.
Ayla's startled anger is quivering in time with my own like a sustained, high-pitched note.
We're done talking.
Sure, sure. We're done.
His words eat at me in the silence that follows. The day after our patrol, I receive a memo from the ministry summoning me to the office of Miranda Hayne. My walk to the inner palace is spent trying to calm an elevated heart rate. This is it. That memo I ignored before the Fourth Order. The morale visit lists my name has been absent from. This is when I face the person behind it. The Minister of Propaganda. Still seething from Power's insinuations, I'm almost relieved for this change. Here, at least, is something I can face.
Antigone, hello. Thank you for coming.
Miranda Hayne has risen and, to my surprise, is smiling. The Ministry of Propaganda is the only ministry headed by a woman, and my first thought meeting her is of skyfish ladies from the Dragonborn tapestries. She has the same warm brown complexion, regal posture, and dark curls framing a clear gaze. Although unlike the ladies of those tapestries, Hane wears trousers, and her hair is cropped chin length. Behind her, a floor-to-ceiling window overlooks the fire mouth, lined with potted plants that diffuse the sunlight. There's stiffness in my arms and fingers that have nothing to do with tournament injuries, and I find myself unsure where to place my hands. At my sides? In my pockets? Hane extends her own hand, and I realize, belatedly, that she expects me to shake it, like we're adult males. Please sit. After I've taken a seat across from her, on the edge of it, because I can't make my body relax, she studies me from under dark eyebrows. I remind myself to sit straighter. I realize that my arms are crossed. I unfold them and then clench my fingers in my lap. My burns twinge. Congratulations on making finalist. You flew very well. Thank you. Sitting across from her, my courage is flagging like a sail on a dying breeze. For the first time, it occurs to me that I must have been mad, a stubborn, reckless fool, to take that note as a challenge. This woman helms one of the most powerful branches of government, and I took it upon myself to defy her? I've been reviewing your file. My racing thoughts pause. Hane taps a folder in front of her, the only item on her otherwise clear leather-topped desk. You have nothing but the highest marks in all your classes, but your teachers routinely note that you don't speak up enough. The exceptions are your new dragon tongue professor and the first protector, who find your participation over the last few weeks more than satisfactory. Your only low marks are in oration, but your rhetoric professor observes that since making the fourth order, you've been applying yourself with more determination. Would you agree with these assessments? Mouth clamped shut, I nod. The cloister directress, Gillian Mortmain, reports that you get along well with others and are not without friends. Your drill master, Wes Gorin, describes your abilities in the air as dubious at best, and your tendencies subservient. Though I can only assume, given your performance in the last two tournaments I've observed, that his reporting has been misleading. Power's question returns to me, biting. Do you know what they say about you? I hesitate, then nod again. A look of distaste passes over Hane's face. Just with you or all the girls? Or is it your birth? I've never been asked about Gorin like this before. I open my mouth, but no words come out. Hane speaks first, sounding tired. You don't have to answer that. She looks me over with a twisting frown, then exhales, slowly and audibly through her nose. I will my face not to go blotchy, as I can feel it's on the verge of doing. All right, Antigone. I think I must be imagining the tone of concession in her voice. She's opened my file and begun flipping through it. Past reports from teachers, work samples, flight pattern analyses, test scores, medical history. She stops on the page titled Bio and glances it over. I watch her eyebrows rise, a line appear between them. She blinks, shakes her head a little like she's clearing it, and looks up. She doesn't comment on what she's just read. I'm going to assign you a morale visit. I let out the breath I didn't realize I'd been holding. The details of the process wash over my numb ears. My first morale visit will be to Holborn Hill, my home village. I'm to assist Lee's morale visit to Cheapside first to get an idea of what they're looking for. I'm to draft a speech, if I so choose, and I'm to pick another guardian as a visiting partner. It will be the first time I've been back to Holborn in 10 years. Do you have any questions? A single doubt is nagging. I hesitate. Hane prompts me with a motion of her hand. Do we have to bring dragons? I ask. Hane tilts her head at the question, like it perplexes her. Yes, she says. That is the point of these visits, Antigone. You're appearing as a dragon rider, which means showing the people your dragon. She's looking at me expectantly, like she expects me to explain myself. But all I can feel is my fluttering stomach. Finally, I've been given a morale visit. A single morale visit. A chance to prove that I deserve it. Against what must be this woman's better judgment and certainly her first inclinations. And now I question her? Nevertheless, the words blurt from my mouth. Mightn't we make an exception? I close it abruptly, look down, feel the blotchiness starting up my neck. But Hane's voice contains nothing but understanding. That was years ago, Annie. And this is you. One of theirs, weeks after Kallipolis has been alerted to the threat of Pythian dragonfire. Whatever Holborn voted in the original referendum regarding dragons, they'll know this is different. Over the next few days, I try to convince myself that Hane is right. And I try to find the words to tell Lee that I'll be coming with him to Cheapside. But none come. In any case, speaking of any kind has become oddly weighted since we both made finalist for first rider. The morning of our visit, I find him in the armory, dressed as I am, in ceremonial uniform, looking unusually grim. What are you doing here? I'm coming too. They're having me do a morale visit, but I've got to watch this one first. Lee raises a finger to the bridge of his nose and rubs it. Like he likes the idea of doing Cheapside together as little as I do. Annie, look. When I'm doing these, I... He breaks off, shakes his head, drags his fingers through the side of his dark hair as he avoids my eyes. I understand abruptly. You put on the show they want. For a second, he looks miserable. It means something to them. That's what I've realized. Even if it feels hollow to us, it's not to them. You'll see. We land with our dragons in the cordoned-off part of the main square of Cheapside, next to the rising spire of the neighborhood's dragon perch. It's the first time I've been back since Albans. While the representative from propaganda makes introductions, I study the crowd gathering in front of us. It's strange years later to notice the things that I didn't as a child. Their clothes are worn. Their bodies dirty, thin. Appearances I used to take for granted, but now see as signs of poverty. The wristbands are nearly all iron. With a start, I see a face I recognize. To the edge of the square, a crowd of grubby, downtrodden-looking children are waiting next to our old orphanage master. From the corner of my eye, I can see Lee watching me. Gibbon finishes his introduction and gestures Lee forward, and Lee's attention turns to the audience. Citizens of Kallipolis, he begins. I come to you now in the wake of challenging news for our nation. I've watched Lee speak in class for 8 years. He's always been confident and well-spoken, and poised. But this is the first time I've seen him address a crowd as a representative of the state. His shoulders are thrown back, the silver breast of his uniform gleaming in the sunlight, his black gold-trimmed mantle falling carelessly off one shoulder as he lifts a hand to invoke his audience. A dragon behind him, the crowd in front of him. Lee holds the square captivated like he owns it. The address probably began as a canned text provided by the Ministry of Propaganda, but it's easy for me to detect Lee's doctoring. We've proofread each other's writing for too many years not to recognize the other's style. The ministry's trite phrases become heartsure and meaningful as he breathes them into life. His speechmaking, like his flying, is beautiful. Gibbon, who's come to stand beside me, is smiling a little.
"Every time he's like this," he says.
Lee has them roaring by the end, in a kind of rising crescendo with his words, shrieking their approval as he says that we will never surrender this glorious revolution, this people's revolution, and that we will defend Kallipolis by land and by sea and by air. I try to imagine myself standing where he's standing, doing what he's doing, and can't. They're always happiest when they have a lord. I push the thought away with revulsion. When his speech is over, I stand beside Lee and watch as he receives each citizen in the greeting line. He puts them at ease, listens patiently, and focuses on each person with his whole attention. Nothing throws him off. Not when they tell him their grievances, or ask him to place his hand on their child, or even weep with fear about the coming war.
I just keep thinking, what if they spark before ours? What if they've already sparked?
We're training for that very possibility every day. The mother's voice goes strained, wild.
But how can we stand a chance if...
Lee lets out a laugh, gentle, and takes the woman's sunburned hand. Her face is lined, her brown hair streaked with grey. At his touch, she looks up at him. Have a little faith in your fleet, madam. She takes in his face like she's looking into the light. For a moment, I see Lee as she must see him, his kind smile, worn by old sorrows, the grey eyes that are both intelligent and full of concern, the dark hair, shining in the sunlight, blown back from his forehead by the breeze, the guardian's emblem of the circlets of silver and gold entwined on his breastplate, the filling shoulders of a boy in the prime of his youth and strength, the face that is beginning to transform into a man's, the man's face that grows day by day more familiar. The woman raises his hand to her lips, kisses it, and breath leaves me like it's been sucked from my lungs, because it is unmistakably a politeness from before the revolution, from a time when subjects showed their gratitude to dragon lords in the ways they'd been taught. Lee has gone rigid. And then, when he looks up, it's at me, watching him. His face has drained of colour. There are conversations I wish we'd never had as children. Things I hope we'll never say again. Realizations I wish I need never have had or have. But the realization I most regret, the one I hate and resist most of all, is that while I've always known what he is, the worst thing is not what he is, but who. That even if I'd never been told exactly who Leo was, I've begun to recognize his maturing face. Lee, Leo,
Leon.
The greeting line moves on, and the thought is pushed back to the silence where I prefer it. When those in the line want to speak to me, I do my best to imitate Lee, even though I feel self-conscious and tongue-tied. When it's nearly over and I feel as drained as if we'd been doing it for hours, I hear a familiar voice say our names.
All right, Lee? Annie?
The orphanage master uses a chummy voice, as if to make clear to those watching that he's on a first-name basis with us. He prods the first children forward. Lee guides them to Palor, and I bring the next group of children to Ayla. She huffs and, at my clucking and snapped fingers, lowers her head reluctantly to their height. The children reach out with trembling, tentative fingertips to brush her amber scales. It's strange to realize that these children, who seem so tiny, are the same age we once were at Albin's. One of the girls in my group bursts into tears. I go cold with panic. Why is she crying? What did I do? How do I make it stop? There are people watching.
Trade?
Lee has appeared at my side, nodding at his own group of children. None of them are crying. Leaving them with me, he approaches the crying girl from my group, scoops her up as if it's the most natural thing in the world and says,
"Hey."
Like he's shed one skin and slipped into another. And this one, too, I recognize. Not the man growing visible under his ceremonial armor like a molting bird of prey, but the boy I knew in Albin's. The boy who had no father, who reminded me of no one, who mattered to me only because in a world where we had no one, he was kind. I lead the others back to the Albin's section as snatches of Lee's conversation with the girl come from behind me. I know they can be scary, can't they? But that one wasn't going to hurt you. And then, after she says something else, too incoherent for me to understand, he adds, "I'm sorry you miss your mum." My eyes are beginning to burn with the memories. His words of comfort are gentle, practiced. Because of course he has practiced them. When he passes me, and our glances catch for a brief moment, I realize that his eyes have reddened too. Back with the others, he sets the girl on her feet and tells her, a firmness entering his voice, that it's time to stop crying. And to my surprise, she does. Steals herself, wipes her face, nods with determination. Was that me? And the worst thought that has me sick with shame, is that me still? What would it be like to serve as Alterna to this boy, whom of all people I should refuse to serve? And what perversion of upbringing or nature makes that easier for me to envision than becoming his superior? A revolution was fought to undo these patterns, and yet here I am, unable to picture any future but one where I repeat them. That won't do. That can't do. I won't let it. I will not let power be right. Not about my people. Not about my desires. Not about me.
3 days before my morale visit to Holbin, Krissa finds me working at a table in the solarium after we've gotten out of training. Specialists in dragon biology have begun inspecting the fleet, offering suggestions for ways to trigger the dragon's spark fire. So far, none of their recommendations have had any effect. We're left training with pikes and shields.
What are you working on?
Chris is smiling, using her most cheerful squadron leader voice, the one that I now associate with clinging to Rock's shoulders as we raced through the moonlit palace, a flag around my shoulders and joy in my blood. She takes the seat across from me,
and nods at the paper in front of me as her fingers rake golden hair back from her face.
My speech?
For your morale visit.
I nod, remembering Lee in Cheapside. As far as I could tell, he didn't even bother to write his down. The speech I'm staring at has taken me 3 hours of drafting and redrafting to compose.
Do you want me to look it over?
Krissa makes this offer so promptly that I realize it must be the real reason she's taken a seat across from me. The problem is, the idea of having anyone read the thing makes me feel like throwing up. I assess this reaction and decide it's probably a bad sign. Anyway, as far as my options go, Krissa's aren't a bad set of eyes. She gets good marks in oration, and even if we're not best friends, I do trust her. I push the paper across the table, defying my roiling stomach. When she finishes, she has to clear her throat before speaking, and I realize that her eyes are a little bright. It's really good, Annie. I unfold my arms, which I realize have twisted together as I watched her read.
Oh, thanks. Have you practiced it at all? Saying it?
I shake my head. Krissa looks down at the speech and then back at me, her forehead wrinkling.
You probably should. It's going to be important that you stay composed. Nobody likes watching girls cry. It makes them too uncomfortable. And saying this aloud would probably make me cry.
That's been my worry too.
Maybe I shouldn't do it.
Krissa shakes her head.
No, you absolutely should do it. But you should practice the hell out of it first. In front of someone.
Did you practice? When you first started doing morale visits? She's been doing visits as frequently as any of the higher-ranked boys, and far from surprising me, it fits the pattern I've observed from afar for years. Krissa's charm and confidence give her a success within the system that slips past most unnoticed, but that I've always regarded as a kind of miracle.
Krissa nods. Of course I practiced.
She seems to sense my surprise and adds, with a roll of her eyes and a flick of hair from her shoulder,
I mean, I'm no cult leader. I'm not Lee. But when I put in the work, I like to think I get the job done.
I let out a startled laugh. After brooding for so many days on what I saw at Cheapside, it's strange to hear Lee's charisma joked about so unceremoniously. For the first time since I stood next to him during his morale visit, I feel the knot in my chest loosen a fraction.
Krissa does this. People who aren't Lee do this.
She gets to her feet.
Come on, she says, tugging my arm.
What?
I'm going to coach you.
Over the next 3 days, I move from training to class to patrols to rounds in a haze of anticipation, sometimes excitement, sometimes foreboding. I push away the unimaginable thought of Ayla at Holbin and focus on the speech, which I go over and over with Krissa until I know it cold. I think of the Mackies, how they embraced me and brought me Highland flowers the day of the Fourth Order tournament, and their letter to me before my match with Power. I tell myself that the pit of doubt and shame left in the wake of Power's insinuations will soon have its answer. Whatever uncertainty I've had about ascending to First Rider in place of Lee, surely it will be cured by the sight of home, the faces of those for whom it would mean so much if I succeeded. Surely Holbin will give me the strength to prove Power wrong. For the first time in years, I allow myself to remember everything I miss about it. The jagged rocks protruding from impossibly green fields, the wind off the North Sea rippling the grass like waves. I choose Duck as my visiting partner. The ministry's reply suggests a preference,
in not-so-subtle terms that I take Lee instead, and I ignore it. No, absolutely not. I know enough to know that Leo has no place in Holbin.
Don't be nervous, Duck tells me in the armory the morning of. You'll do great.
Duck, it's not going to be as easy as it was for your and Kor's neighborhood.
I know.
It's a half-hour flight to Holbin, and on the way, as we ride in silence, I can feel all the nerves I've been suppressing for the last few days take over. When we land, Duck says simply,
"It's beautiful."
Holbin Hill is in the lower ranges of the Western Highlands, on the base of the mountains. As I dismount, I inhale air that's cleaner than anything I've breathed in months. The light this high on the mountain is tinged with silver, and the wind smells of cold rocks and heather. We're on a stony clearing, a little south of the village, awaited by the Mackey family, whom I haven't seen since the first tournament, and Miranda Hayne herself, who made the journey on horseback alongside a small contingent of ministry officials.
I decided I would see to this visit personally, Hayne tells me, smiling.
I feel a flutter of a different kind of nerves at the sight of her. How much is her presence meant to be a support, and how much is it a test?
Annie, you remember Don Mackey? Hayne goes on, still smiling at me. He's the village leader who helped organize this visit. He said his family came to see you at your first tournament.
I nod, and Mackey smiles.
Hello again, Annie.
His eyes flick past me toward Ayla and Serta, their folded wings rippling in the wind, then return to my face with determination.
There they are, says Mackey's son.
A trail of people are trickling down the path from the collection of buildings that make up the village. Their buildings look new and well-made. Atreus took special care in the years after the revolution to fund reconstruction of villages destroyed by dragonfire. Flocks of sheep, visible as ambling spots of white on the surrounding hillside, have multiplied since I was last here. Evidence of Atreus's incentives to grow textile exports and wean Kallipolis off reliance on subsistence farming. My heart's begun to race, my palms to sweat. Eventually, they're all standing level with us, but they keep to the far side of the clearing, farther back than even Mackey.
Please, come closer, Hayne says.
People glance at each other like they're trying to decide if this is an order, and what might happen if they don't comply. Some take a few steps closer. I recognize almost everyone, though I've forgotten a lot of names. I search the villagers' expressions for any sign of welcome, and though there are a few smiles, most have their eyes on the dragons and look wary. Hayne steps forward, introduces us, and then invites me to begin. My stomach, which has been lurching, goes still at her cue. I remember how easily Lee stepped into this moment, as naturally as a dragon kicking off the ground. But there's no point comparing it with that.
Stand straight, Chrissa told me on the arena ramparts where we stood 10 meters apart to practice. Hold your head up. Remember that you fly a dragon and try to look like it.
I begin. I describe the first attack on Holbin, then the second. I can tell it's surprising them that I'm talking about it at all. And whispering breaks out, but I'm in no place to stop or second-guess myself, so I keep going. Describing the attacks is the hardest part. But my voice is steady and clear, just like it was on the ramparts with Chrissa. Then I describe the revolution, how Holbin took part in the overthrow of the old regime. I describe the changes that Atreus has made, in and out of the city. I describe the education I'm receiving, thanks to a merit-based test.
I describe a government where dragons abide by laws rather than create them. I tell them that the Pythians have declared their intentions to retake Kallipolis. I tell them that I've seen the Pythians and their dragons myself. I tell them that the revolution was not the end of it after all, that it seems it was only the beginning of a whole new war. A war we must, at all costs, win. As a guardian and dragon rider, I've sworn to defend this island. As a finalist for first rider, I'm contending for more than that. I am contending to lead the Kallipolan aerial fleet. Though I've said it over and over in rehearsal, it is only now, in front of the villagers of Holbin, that the shiver goes down my spine at the words. The realization all over again of the sheer miracle of it. Me, a serf, a Holbiner, contending for first rider. I am also a farmer's daughter, a villager of Holbin Hill, an orphan. I know how it feels to be hungry. I've seen Dragonfire take everything I cared about away. I am one of you. So are every single one of my fellow dragon riders. We're here to protect you, as the old dragon riders did not. Even if you can't believe the words, please remember the facts. My family died at the hands of the old regime, and I would sooner die than see its crimes repeated. I'm finished. There's just silence. I look over at Hain, and she gives me a small nod. As far as she's concerned, I did it right. She steps forward and begins to introduce the next stage of the visit. I permit myself to close my eyes, reach out, and place a hand on Ayla's neck, taking in a calming breath. If you'd like to come forward, Antigone, Annie, and Dorian will receive you. I'm sure you must be glad to see Annie again after so many years and want to wish her good luck in the final tournament. I look up from Ayla. No one has moved. Mackie and Hain look at each other. Mackie says, "Now then, don't be shy. Boris, you and Helga want to start us off." And quietly to me, he adds, "Annie, take a few steps forward from that dragon of yours. There's a good girl." A trickling line of villagers begins to form, moving toward us with unmistakable reluctance across the rocky clearing. When Boris and Helga, with their three children, arrive within speaking distance, I see Boris's knees soften at the same time Hain does. "Please remain standing," Hain says sharply. I feel the back of my neck ignite with heat, flowing into my face. "Thank you for coming," I say. It occurs to me for the first time how I must sound to them. The Highland accent gone, the clipped vowels and flat tones of palace standard speech. Austere and sterile, like a ministry official. Boris and Helga look at each other. Their children are gathered at their heels, the youngest peering at our dragons from between his mother's legs. They incline their heads without a word and turn away. It goes on like this, the silence and the stiffness, until I'm greeted by a woman whom I remember was widowed in the second Holbin attack. Now 10 years older, her face lined with care, her graying hair bound with a faded black scarf, she approaches me, glares, and says, "Your father would be ashamed of you, girl." And then she spits. She is taller than me. The wind and gravity carry it easily across the short distance between us onto my face. For a moment, the shock of it leaves me frozen. And then behind me, Ayla lets out a low whine. I clench my fists to prevent a spillover, willing my head clear, willing Ayla to calm. But then I hear other noises. Growling, hissing, another dragon's wings snapping open. Duck has spilled over. Serta feels his outrage. Hain steps forward on one side of me, Mackie on the other, their eyes wide and panicked. And all the while, the widow still stands before me, glaring and defiant, like she's daring me to prove her right. I look behind me. Duck's pupils are dilated. One of his hands has reached up to seize Serta's reins. The other is a balled fist at his side. I tell him, "If you cannot control Serta, please remove her." And then I turn back to the widow, wipe my face, and force the words out. "Summer's blessings on your house." The next villager spits too.
Lee.
On the day of my second meeting with Julia, it's difficult to focus on anything but what I'll say when we see each other. Her letter, its vision, has a way of twisting and reshaping whenever I try to grasp at what is wrong with it. For when I'm summoned from class and sent to Atreus's office, all thought of Julia slides from my mind. I remember, with foreboding, that Annie's visit to Holbin was scheduled for today as well. Inside Atreus's office, Annie is perched on one of the dark-stained chairs facing Atreus, making a report in a quiet voice. Duck sits beside her, head in his hands. Miranda Hain is standing to the side, her arms folded, her expression stony, but it softens when she sees me. "Lee, please come in," she says, beckoning. I have the impression she intends my presence and name to offer some comfort to Annie. She looks surprised when Annie cringes instead. She doesn't turn her head, doesn't look at me. I realize, as I come closer, that tears are coursing silently and steadily down her cheeks while she speaks. Her handkerchief is clutched in one hand, forgotten. And then I hear what she's describing. "And you used only words of courtesy and kept Ayla calm to the end," Atreus asks quietly when she seems to have nothing left to say. Annie nods. This high in the inner palace, sunlight is still able to pour long swaths across the room from the windows looking out of the fire mouth, and it glows on the red-brown hair of her downturned head and trembling shoulders. Atreus and Hain exchange a look that Annie doesn't notice. After years of straining for the rare demonstrations of Atreus's approval, I see the signs of it now, though only the faintest lifted eyebrow betrays it. But Annie does not seem to be in a state to appreciate the approval of anyone. "Was it the speech?" she asks in a whisper, clutching her knees with whitening fingers. Hain's eyes are full.